everyone. Welcome back to the Conservative Woman's Guide. I'm your host, Karen Lips. Today, I am joined by Emily Jasinski, culture editor at The Federalist and host of the Federalist Radio Hour, for an episode on the Conservative Woman's Guide to the 2024 election. Before joining The Federalist, Emily was a commentator writer for The Washington Examiner and a spokeswoman for Young America's Foundation. She currently serves as director of the National Journalism Center and co-hosts the weekly news show Counterpoints Friday. Originally from Wisconsin, she graduated from George Washington University, and that's where I met her when she was involved in New There. With the 2024 presidential election coming up, Emily, students on college campuses will likely engage in more political conversation, and I'd guess more disagreements with their peers. Knowing how to talk about the election in a productive way on campus is vital. Emily's here today to provide tips on how to have civil discourse with those across the aisle and how to explain your point of view. Before we get into the interview, make sure you're subscribed to the Conservative Woman's Guide wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, leave us a 5-star review. Welcome, Emily. I very much look forward to this discussion as election season picks up.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it too, Karen. And your introduction was so lovely and reminded me that at this point, we kind of go way back. That was like more than 10 years ago.
I know. Wow. It's been fun watching your career and see you succeed and see you wear all types of different hats, from writing commentary to TV to being on your podcast earlier, I guess last year at this point. So great to have you on.
Well, it's always great to talk.
Yes. I want to start with your show Counterpoints. You and your progressive co-host discuss current events, offering very different perspectives on them. You can spend your time doing lots of things, right? There's always more articles to write, more podcasts to record. But you have chosen to spend time in your career purposely engaging in these conversations with a progressive. Why do you think it's important to discuss issues with someone who has such a different perspective? And what are some strategies you employ to make those conversations productive?
It sounds probably cheesy, but we find common ground all of the time, which is really interesting and unexpected. Ryan and I started doing what we were doing after Crystal Ball and Sagar and Jetty, two people who are also on the kind of opposite sides, started doing this over at The Hill, and now they do it at their channel Breaking Points, and were kind enough to let us have a show on their network, and they modeled it for us. And a lot of people always thought of these kind of media conversations from both sides looking like crossfire, where you have someone that's really partisan on one side and really partisan on another side. So it's sort of like a binary. But what we try to do is have somebody who's like ideologically conservative and ideologically closer to socialism. And instead of being, married to one side of the aisle, that way you kind of have more freedom to explore what's in between, whether it's policy, whether it's ideas. You don't have to defend one particular side. And I think that's been really very liberating. And that also was kind of a tip for people too, is, when you are finding yourself, this is what I love about journalism, defending, whether it's a political party or a particular politician, a lot of times that's easier to kind of makes it easier to kind of get lost and you lose your sort of bearings ideologically. But when you're able to kind of think outside, and this is crazy, in Washington, D.C., I think that's one of the problems here is, people are so entrenched. But when you're actually outside of the boundaries of partisanship, you can stumble into some really interesting places. And so the reason I spend time doing this, I think it's so much fun. It feels like, the pioneer, like exploring the West at this point, because it's like it hasn't been tread in so long, some of this ground. But the tips, honestly, is you having a sense of humor and genuinely really, not taking yourself too seriously, but genuinely really respecting the other person. Because if you don't respect them, it's going to show through and you're going to get caught up in these like very non-productive blocks because you think the other person's lying or you think the other person's dumb. But if you really respect them and are really curious about what they think and they're coming from a position of good faith, man, you could go anywhere. So I just love it. I think it's a blast.
Well, I really appreciate that distinction, Emily, being a, you know, wearing the conservative hat versus wearing a partisan, for example, Republican hat. Could you talk about maybe where there's a difference there or an issue that by wearing your conservative hat, you've gone a different way than some of those who are outspoken as conservatives on TV?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think one issue... There's the issues and then there's the politics of it. And one thing that the media gets caught up in a lot, whether it's sort of the pundit class on the right or the broader like journalist pundit class on the left, which is basically everybody who's in front of a camera in DC, but they get caught up in worrying about their sourcing. They get caught up in worrying about getting, you know, chewed out by the DNC if they say something about the politics, even like issues aside, but even if they say, for example, something about the politics of life and abortion or the politics of gender ideology. They're really careful. This is like inside baseball. You know this, Karen, but like people are so careful when they talk on, you know, whether it's CNN, MSNBC, Washington Post, they're really, really careful because they don't want to aggravate their sources. They don't want to aggravate people in positions of power. And so I think one thing of just sort of swearing off any concern about that allows you to really, so like, for example, with the issue of IVF or abortion, that's one area where it's you know, I don't worry about what the RNC thinks of what I say. I don't worry about what anybody says about what I say because I do think the politics of it, it's important to admit the politics of it are extremely difficult. It is an uphill climb for the right to make the moral case. That doesn't mean the moral case is any less moral. It does mean that it's a much more difficult case to make to the American people. The American people aren't with, you know, a lot of, they aren't with me as a pretty hardcore pro-life person. I'm a very minority position in this country. And so just being able to kind of like acknowledge that, that's one of the things I like about my job is just when you could come from a place of honesty and not pretending that the American people are all for, you know, limiting abortion and all of that. It's just not true. You know, it's true where the, not to get into the issue, but it's true that, you know, the American people are much closer to the pro-life side than what the media tells you, and that where the Democratic Party is, there's no question, where the left is, there's no question about it. But, you know, it's also true that it's an uphill climb for candidates in states like Michigan or Wisconsin or Pennsylvania. So I think just being unfettered from a party apparatus is incredibly helpful, and you can kind of go in different directions.
Well, and that separation between the policy and the politics matters, right? So you can, that's, I think, one tip that we'll give our students on campus is like, you can have the policy discussions, you can also have the politics discussions, and it's helpful to distinguish where you are on things. Because whereas you might be able to win some students over on the policy, the moral ground on something, then when you start to put an R or a D on it and it gets into politics, sometimes people say, maybe some young people are willing to just, you know, follow their leader without thinking, you know, being as thoughtful about it. Do you find that that distinction is very important in those discussions with young people? And if you, are there any other strategies you've encouraged them to employ?
Yeah. And I'm curious, I imagine you found the same thing, but poll after poll has found that especially Gen Z, Gen Alpha, they do not want to identify with the political party, even more than millennials, more than Gen X, more than boomers at this stage in their life. They want to identify as political independents. Obviously, this is going to be amplified by the two.
But that often means Democrats, right?
Right. So where the policy falls, they'll often be with the Democratic Party. But with the label, they're really uncomfortable with the label, which is, I think, kind of interesting because you know, the binary in this particular election is especially like offensive to young people. It's a redo of 2020. It's two elderly people that are not broadly popular. Neither is a broadly popular figure and definitely not popular with young people. So it's just, I feel like this is amplifying those anti to the anti-binary feelings, and I don't mean binary as a pun. I meant it in the political sense in this case. But that, you know, we see young men in particular in some polls starting to embrace surprisingly conservative positions on biological sex, on gender roles and all that stuff in ways that we didn't see happening with millennials, with Gen X. And so we see women going in the opposite direction, though, young women going in the opposite direction. And this is setting up a strange brew on campuses, as you know, Karen, and then also in the workplace and in marriages and communities. So we'll have to see what happens. But I do think it's interesting that more than any other, polling is like pretty consistent that more than any other generation at this point, the labels are not being embraced by Zoomers. And that, I mean, well, I don't know where that goes.
Well, it was interesting, Emily. Cosmo wrote an article maybe a month or so ago where they identified seven Gen Zers and talked to them about the election. And as you might imagine, there was only one conservative that they included of their seven. And the one they picked was the only male. So as if conservative women just don't exist.
Classic.
So that's a good example of how the left often kind of treats conservative women. But I'm curious on your take, as you started to talk about, you know, the candidates, what would you expect the atmosphere to be like on campus among young women? And especially with these two candidates, because we're not just talking about the election in general, but with a Joe Biden versus Donald Trump election, what does this mean for the environment, the tone, the atmosphere on campus? And what advice do you have for conservative women?
Yeah, I guess nobody on campus now was on campus in 2015, 2016, when the early Trump campaign started out, and then when it was Trump versus Hillary Clinton. But on that note, actually, because people weren't on campus then, you know, it's worth looking back on what happened in 2015 and 2016. And it was really tough for conservative women who, you know, in most cases, conservative women don't love Donald Trump. Yeah, exactly. They're not in love with Donald Trump, but they may say, hey, I'm making a moral decision to support Donald Trump because I'm really pro-life, or I think the open border is a complete disaster, or I, you know, I'm terrified about the Biden foreign policy, or there was a YAF poll, I think, earlier last month that found the economy is actually the one thing that's weighing heavier on Gen Z than anything else. And, you know, maybe that's informing your decision to vote for Joe, or to vote against Joe Biden. And, you know, that is going to put you in a really uncomfortable position on your college campus because they will not take it as a moral decision. It was the refrain over and over again, as you know very well, Karen, in 2015 and 2016, is that anyone who supports Donald Trump is necessarily, in some cases, racist would be the argument, is necessarily, in other cases, pro-sexual abuse, is a bigot, is anti-woman. It's a binary categorization. If you are with the Republican Party or if you're with the conservative side of an argument, you will necessarily be put in these awful categories. And that is just about the worst thing in that sort of political context or ideological context, even a social context that can happen on your college campus. It's really like, it is going to get that bad so that it's black and white and you're on the dark side and they're on the light side. You're a bigot. You're destroying the country. And it's really difficult. Really difficult to overcome that. It definitely is like socially ostracizing, isolating. If you have a new chapter on your campus, that makes it way less isolating and you have strength in numbers, which makes a huge, huge difference in terms of your ability to stand by what are your principles. So that's, you know, my advice is to have those strength in numbers and have things like new chapters because that gives you way more strength than you even realize until it happens, until, you know, someone starts coming for you, then you realize how grateful you are for it.
I mean, I think you paint, I'm sorry to say it, but I think you paint the picture accurately that as a conservative on campus during an election year, like, it's pretty bleak, right? Like, it's hard. I think people are quicker to label you, as you mentioned, and socially ostracize you. And so it's a real problem. So what do you recommend? Do you recommend students keep quiet about their views? I don't want to do that because I think there's so much value in engaging with the other side and having those nuanced discussions and arguments. How would you navigate when, you know, you'd recommend that a conservative speaks up or tries to raise an issue to talk about?
Yeah, I used to recommend, you know, sort of being more judicious about it. You know, if you need a good grade, do what you need to do to get the good grade. I certainly did that myself. And then as the intensity of some of these conflicts increased, I looked at it and thought, you know, to some extent, it's empowered the forces of censorship, suppression on campus, especially in professor positions, to, you know, continue steamrolling American culture and young people and Christians and pro-life people, everyone. And so now I really don't recommend that because I also think it's important to learn how to just the interpersonal relationships, how to navigate the interpersonal relationships. You are paying a crazy amount of money to go to your school.
Yes.
And so it's important for you to push your professors to be the best, to be what you deserve, to be what other students deserve, to be what the state, in some cases, that subsidizes your university, the taxpayers that subsidize your university as a public good that should be affecting the state positively, to push for what everyone deserves. It's sort of a civic responsibility, and it teaches you to put your best foot forward. You have to push yourself to learn to put your best foot forward and to write in a way or to talk in class in a way that, you know, makes you, it's always, you're the one that's swimming upstream. If you're a conservative, you're the one that has the kind of handicap, like golf, that's you, if you're on campus. So you're the one that has to like really push yourself. It's not fair, but it is reality. So it teaches you to be the best, you can be in terms of arguing, in terms of appealing to other people, in terms of just getting along, which is increasingly something we have to do as Hollywood is making movies about a potential civil war over red and blue states, all of that stuff. Be the best that you can be in terms of having conversations with people who disagree with you. Campus is actually a great place to learn that. So I just don't recommend skirting those opportunities. And I don't say that pretending it's easy. I know exactly how hard it is. It is really hard. I wish I would have done more of it. And I think if we all sort of vote in the campus culture war with our actions, then we'll have better campuses. It just takes a little bit more from conservatives. We have to sort of push ourselves more and kind of see it as a civic responsibility, I guess.
Well, and one thing we see, Emily, is that when one person speaks out, it often attracts more, right? So if you're willing to be that one to speak out, then, you know, other women in your classes will come up to you afterwards and say, oh, I thought the same thing. And you might be able to, in a way, empower more people to speak out. So then it doesn't seem like your opinion and that your views, that you're so alone out there. So Emily, one thing I think is interesting about campuses is that the students often have, you know, a set of views on certain issues, but then new things come up, right? Each election season will bring up new issues that, you know, maybe somebody hasn't thought that much about. And some of the professors have, and they'll have very strong opinions on them. But what do you recommend students do in terms of preparing for the election when there's a new issue? Are there particular news sources or other places that you encourage them to read articles? I just think engaging becomes a little bit easier if they're really educated on the issue. So where do you go when there's something kind of new popping up that you want to learn about before you start stating your opinion publicly?
That's a great question. My honest answer to that is the first thing I do is genuinely look at the Federalist, which sounds like a company answer, but it is, you know, one thing I love about the Federalist is that totally, as we were talking about before, untethered to any party apparatus or any sort of loyalties. And that's where I recommend people look in general. Like, I think Federalist does that. I think there are other publications. I think there are other publications that do that. You know, I listen to Ben Shapiro, like most young people, and I love Michael Knowles. You know, I recommend going to sources that are not going to be worried about, you know, getting those calls from this campaign or that campaign when they treaded a little bit too far in, you know, one direction or the other, because it's going to hurt their access or hurt their sourcing or hurt their ability to get on that campaign bus. And another thing that I do, this, Mike, this is to the extent that I have any like secrets, is just sort of pay obsessive attention to what the left is saying and go to the places that the left is making the best version of its argument. So again, that's typically not going to be NBC News. That's typically not going to be Cosmo. That's, you know, from my perspective, that is usually places like Jacobin or The Intercept, where you have very thoughtful people on the left, well-intentioned people on the left, who I think are extremely wrong, dangerously wrong. But they are making the most honest case for their side. And so I will sort of read that, then go and check my work with people on the right, you know, maybe with a Michael Knowles, maybe with Margot Cleveland and the Federalists on some of these legal cases, and then compare and contrast and say, okay, so this is what this is saying. This is what this is saying. I put them together. And then you could kind of weigh the evidence. As Karen, you're a pro at, because you have a law degree. You understand this. I like thinking of it that way, like weighing, like giving them both opportunities to testify. But I think in order to do that, you really have to go to the honest sources on the left, you know, and not the sort of propaganda sources on the left, because then you're just getting this caricature of the liberal argument, this hysteric sort of beltway caricature of the liberal argument, not the actual argument itself.
Well, thanks for sharing that behind the scenes. I think it's easy to, right, assume that when people are on podcasts or TV, that they're sort of just thinking in the moment, but a lot of the pundits that I really respect, I know behind the scenes, they are spending hours, you know, doing their research, reading, really becoming educated on the issues, and quite frankly, kind of having those internal dilemmas about things and realizing that a lot of the issues are tougher and that there's more things to be considered than what you might hear in a, you know, 20-second soundbite.
Oh, and you know who's really good at that? Megyn Kelly always pushes me, because she really does give fair opportunities to both sides to make the argument. And you can see sometimes how she's weighing them and is like being just obsessively fair and thoughtful about it. And just there are definitely people who do that. And a lot of them are on Substack. Matt Taibbi is really, I follow Matt Taibbi, Barry Weiss, all of those like fantastic, Michael Schellenberger, all those fantastic Substack voices. I really like Miranda Devine, because this is people who generally don't give, you know, they don't care about what the success of one party or the other is. It's just you're weighing the evidence and figuring out what's moral. So anyway, sorry for that little tangent.
No, I think that's good advice. And I'm curious, with the 2024 election, I know that issues can change, but what do you expect to be the biggest issues that young people are talking about and thinking about? I know you mentioned the pull on the economy, that being a top issue. Anything else come to mind that you might recommend students, you know, really prepare on?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think abortion is going to be huge, because I think, you know, we already see through some reporting that the left is planning to make that a massive campaign issue, for the reasons that, you know, we kind of got into a little bit earlier, that women, female voters in particular, are really easy to sort of get over to the left when you make that a front and center campaign issue in the way they think they can do. I don't know if they can do it, but because they have such radical positions ultimately. But I would really, and I remember, Karen, as you definitely remember in 2016, how hard it was to say that you were on the right, even if you were not supporting Donald Trump. You were called all kinds of horrible things just on the life issue alone. That debate moment between Trump and Clinton, where they were talking about partial birth abortion, and that thrust it right into the spotlight. Everyone was talking about the morality of abortion and all of that. And if you were anywhere near Donald Trump on that, you were called horrible names, and it became very, very hard board, the social pressure to defend your position on life became very, very difficult. And that's going to happen with issues over and over again. If you are, you know, when I was in college, the big issue was Occupy Wall Street. So if you are, you know, anywhere near the Republican Party on entitlement reform or anything like that, you are going to be called a greedy capitalist pig who doesn't care about the plight of workers. But obviously, as the economy will be, I think, front and center, I think that might be the top issue in November. Man, obviously, people are going to have to be really prepared to talk about what they think on Israel, which is, I think, the single most difficult topic, but a good opportunity for everyone to like dig in, do their research, figure out where they stand and why, not just, you know, reflexively one direction or the other, but really dig down, because that's going to be, especially with young voters, that's going to be a huge push on campuses. And the last thing I'll say is I think there's going to be the media is underestimating how serious the third party challenge will be from RFK Jr., who's getting on ballots in all kinds of swing states and is more popular than either candidate with young voters. And so I would encourage young conservative women in particular to prepare when they're confronted with, you know, why they're supporting. Maybe they're supporting a conservative candidate over RFK Jr. or an RFK Jr.-like candidate on down ballot races. Get ready to answer that question, because I think that's coming.
So, Emily, as the election approaches and a student has a very strong opinion on an issue and wants to convince their friends on this issue, how would you recommend they go about doing that?
I would say figure out what matters to your friend. What part of the issue is important to them? Do they care about it because they really care about class? Do they care about it because they really care about women's rights? Do they care about it because they really care about freedom, you know, in the marketplace, whatever it is? Then make your argument on that turf, you know, sort of meet them on their own ground. If you in address, you know, why is your position on the issue better for people, if it's about class, better for people who are, you know, in lower socioeconomic positions? Why is your issue actually better for women? And the only other thing I'll add to that is, if this is, you know, especially with Gen Z, people are very open to the idea that the media has been lying to them. And usually that is the case, that the media is very wrong. So if you can come in and say, listen, this is a false narrative, and it's actually better for women to do X, Y, and Z. It's really just the corporate media's position that is being bolstered by, you know, the fact that NBC is owned by Comcast and all of those. Like, you can make this argument on their turf. So figure out what matters to the person you're talking to, and then, you know, show where the false narrative is.
That's such great advice, and something that I mention in the book, You're Not Alone, The Conservative Woman's Guide to College, that you have to know your audience and that you keep your view, but you often can make your point in a few different ways. So figure out which one is going to resonate with the person you're talking with. So I think that's great advice. And Emily, I want to end by asking you one last question. What advice would you give to your college age self?
Oh, man. great question. I would say read more. And this is something I always find myself telling new students when I'm talking to them, because it's me projecting what I feel like was my own deficiency. But I really say read physical books. It could be Kindle or whatever, but read more. Get your head out of the internet, out of your phone, even out of the cloud that we're all, you know, it's the air that we breathe now, but read. I like almost exclusively read nonfiction, but if it's anything, like, go read your Harry Potter books, like, just read anything, because it focuses your mind. It opens your mind up, makes you think about, you know, envision the characters, use your imagination, and it gets us out of these sort of doom spirals and anxiety spirals that we are on constantly when we're online. So reading is just such a great thing. It's such a blessing that we can even do it. We're very lucky to have so many books, have so much freedom with the books that we are able to read. And so I would just say, just immerse yourself. Just have stacks of books that you want to read. Force yourself to read them. Put your phone down. That would be my advice to my college self.
I love it. Finding those treasured books, there's nothing like it.
100%.
It was great to talk with you today, Emily, and discuss how students can talk about this upcoming election in a productive way on campus. Subscribe to the Conservative Woman's Guide wherever you get your podcasts so that new episodes automatically download. Leave us a 5-star review and share this episode with your friends.